And in fact, we have been guilty in the past of underselling and underinforming people on the organization of the Navigators. I remember one year at this conference where we hardly said anything, and we got more complaints than you could possibly imagine. Where is that presentation on the Navigators? And people are always saying, well, we enjoy the conference, but who are you? We said, we're the other mafia. So this year, what we're going to do is we're going to give two short sessions of an overview during the main part of our time together. Today, we'd like to give you an overview of the International Navigators as sort of an umbrella for what is going on in the world. And tomorrow, Terry Taylor is going to give you an overview of the U.S. Navigators. And of course, since the U.S. Navigators are 50% of the whole, it has an incredible influence on what goes on around the world, particularly in terms of missions. You know, we all want to go down and just look at the ticker tapes or the UPI reports because we wonder what the Senate has voted. We wonder what Saddam Hussein is doing. We wonder whether we're going to go to war. We're disturbed because this morning, if you would have heard the news, you heard that the Marines leadership has said we will probably suffer a 50% casualty rate. And it's not very pretty. And today we are teetering on the edge of war. But that's really nothing new. You know, the world is constantly scarred with wars, most of which you and I don't even hear about. There are over 50 wars going on at any one time around the world today. And this particular war, of course, does affect us very greatly. But there's another war, which is a spiritual battle. And it's a war for the souls of men and women. And it's the reason that the Navigators exist at all. It's to reach people and to help people who are being oppressed in the middle of this war. And our purpose is to reach those people who are being oppressed for Jesus Christ. And once they come to know Christ, to help them grow spiritually and then to reproduce their lives. The Navigators as an organization is 57 years old. And in these six decades of our existence, there are several steel threads, we would call them, that go through the fabric of our society. And the first of those is one that has been our motto for many years, to know Christ and to make him known. And it still is our driving passion. The second steel thread is that we are a lay organization. We're made up in the main amongst our staff of people who have come from professions just like yours. And that we are committed to the proposition that ordinary men and women can make a real difference in their world. And that's why I'm so thrilled at what Howie is speaking on during this time. And the third thread has to do with the things that mark us. And they are very simply evangelism, sharing Christ with those who don't know Christ, person-to-person discipling. That is, that people grow and multiply their lives through other people. And then a focus on knowing, understanding, and applying the Scriptures to our lives. Now, as these threads are related, these threads are related to the United States and to all the nations of the world. We are an international, worldwide organization with staff who are scattered throughout 72 countries. And in reality, we are a mission agency. We are sending people from one country to another throughout the world. And the driving force, the thing that is our ethos, the thing that makes us tick, is the Great Commission to reach every nation and every person in that nation with the gospel of Jesus Christ. Now, we also understand that we're a drop in the bucket. We're just one of hundreds of organizations and church agencies who have that as their mission and vision. But we are one. And we are people who can make a difference around the world. I believe that our particular contribution is to develop a lay disciple-making movement in each of these countries, which are self-sustaining and self-supporting. Now, today, what we would like to do is I would like to have three of the men who relate directly to me in the international office which we call our resident international team, to share with you. Donald McGilchrist, Jim Peterson, and Paul Stanley are international vice presidents responsible with me for leading and influencing the work of the navigators worldwide. First, you're going to hear from Donald McGilchrist, who is going to give us an overview. Donald came to know Christ and his wife Jeannie as adults. Donald was an executive with British Rail Corporation, came to work with the navigators in Britain, and then came to the United States 15 years ago and has served with Lauren Sandy and myself in the international office. Jim Peterson and his wife spent 23 years as missionaries in Brazil, developing from scratch our ministry in Brazil and our entire work in Latin America. And I believe, Jim, you've been back here since 1984? That's 1985. And keeps talking about going back, but his job's not done yet. And then Paul Stanley has just this year joined our team, having come from being a divisional director in the United States with Terry Taylor. Paul is a West Point graduate, and he joined the Navigator staff after having served in the Army for several years. Paul opened our ministries in Eastern Europe and 17 years ago, about, or 18 years ago, and then opened the ministry a little over 10 years ago in Russia, and then served as the leader of our work in Germany and ultimately our leader in all of Europe. So these men are going to come and share with you on the International Ministry of the Navigators. Donald?
Good morning. Good morning. Even after 15 years, I cannot shake my staid British habit of wearing a tie. So I'm afraid it's an addiction. It's probably permanent. And just bear with me in my insecurity, if you would, please. Okay, as Jerry said, I want to just give you a brief overview of the Ministry of the Navigators in the next few minutes. I'm going to use some slides to do that. Let me make two preliminary points. First of all, this ministry that God has entrusted to us, to you and to me, is extremely varied, and we won't be able to capture that just in a few minutes. But bear in mind the variety of it. For example, the extremes of fruitfulness. In Bologna, Italy, we have a Dutchman who's been working 5 years on our staff there, and he has perhaps 2 or 3 converts. He really needs our prayers. At the other end of the spectrum, in South Korea, we have literally thousands of students who come to Christ and make decisions for Christ every year in our student ministry. So there's a lot of spectrum. I'm not going to take any time either to set ourselves in the wider context of the work of Christ and the kingdom of God throughout the world. Please don't take that as arrogance, because we do cooperate joyously with other agencies and with other churches, and we understand that our contribution is limited and specialized. Okay, our aim. The primary aim of the navigators is still to multiply spiritual laborers. And there are 3 essentials, 3 biblical processes that we engage in every country where God has given us a ministry. The processes of evangelizing and establishing and equipping. Within this umbrella of a primary aim, each of our countries has its own strategy, its own planning, its own focus, its own time frame. And they develop their own particular plans. Now, because we are a missions agency, we are engaging not only in evangelizing, establishing, and equipping, but we need to complete the circle that you see on this chart. And we do that by sending. A mission agency is charged with the excitement of the Great Commission, and we want to send spiritual laborers cross-culturally. What is a laborer? A laborer is a Christian disciple, like you or me, who is actively engaged in evangelizing the lost and discipling the saved. Jesus spoke about such people when he said, "The harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few." That situation still persists. We are also a lay movement, but we've no desire to keep track of all the men and women who labor with us, who have been influenced by the work of the navigators, or who are in the harvest fields with us. That's not an objective. Instead, just to give you a flavor of where we are, let's look for a moment at our staff, those who exist to serve and to stimulate this movement. We have something over 3,000 staff, During the 1980s, these men and women increased by about 6% per year. And interestingly enough, you see that we have 44 nationalities of staff. That makes for a stretching diversity, an incredible mosaic of cultures and contexts, a lot of misunderstandings, a lot of creative tension around the world. People who wear ties and can't get used to other things create tension in the breasts of others. Okay. Our staff, as I say, increased by an average of 6% per year. And to me, the exciting milestone that we've reached this year is that for the first time, the navigators are ministering in more than 100 languages around the world. 102 languages. Look at the rapidity of that growth during the last decade. That's a real milestone. How are we organized? Well, not very much. But seriously, we are organized as what we call a global society. Now, a society, according to Webster's dictionary, is a free association of individuals pursuing a common aim. That describes us. That's where we are. So we're voluntarily united. Our basic structure is that we have a general director, Jerry, and we have an international leadership team who meet together formally once a year in what we call our International Council. And then there are connections from those men who live around the world in every continent, those the international leadership team, to the 72 countries in which we have a ministry. Of these 72 countries, 24 are established. By established, we mean three things: biblically rooted, culturally relevant, and continuously effective, in terms, of course, of our primary aim. Interdependent partners in the partnership, in the society called the Navigators. Fully paid up members, if you like. You see, without biblical roots, a ministry will not long endure. Without cultural relevance, a ministry will be superficial. We are committed to the power and mobility of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Therefore, we need ministries that are biblically rooted and culturally relevant. The 24 established countries are shown on the slide in dark blue. Our ministry, of course, originated here in the USA. We went first to the simple places, the English-speaking world. And now we have established countries scattered around the world. The two most recent shown on the chart there, Mexico and Nigeria. This map reminds us of the commission of Jesus Christ. Go and make disciples of all nations. I want to say just a word about nations. What does that word mean? That word we find in Matthew 28 and elsewhere. Well, it means more than countries, doesn't it? In fact, looking at the book of Revelation, there are seven places in the book of Revelation where the men and women who will stand around the throne of God and praise him and rejoice with him forever are mentioned. In each of those seven places in Revelation, three Greek words are used. The word ethnos, or nation, which is a very elastic word, flexible word. The word laos, or people, describes our ethnicity. I'm English. And the word glossa, or language, describes the language that we use. They form a triad, in fact, three powerful ways of looking at the nations, the ethnos to which God has sent us. So strategically, we navigators have decided that we wish to have a presence and to see God bring fruit in every major nation of the world. Here is our definition of a major nation: a population of at least 1 million persons in the year 2000, whom we can look at either through the prism of their ethnicity, such and such a people, or the language they speak, or the country and the passport they carry. Either of these three ways, they form a complementary triad. Well, how are we doing? First of all, let me just say that if we were to pursue this out and take more time over it, there are probably around 440 major nations defined the way that I've just defined them. 240 peoples, 340 languages, and about 140 countries of over 1 million, with a tremendous overlap, naturally. The total, about 440. The navigators, as of today, have a presence in 115 of these 140 major nations. Now, this gives us an agenda, a focus for battle. It positions us as heirs of the covenantal promise that God gave to Abraham, the promise of blessing to the nations. And that is what we are in business to pursue. The blessing of God needs to be brought to the nations of the 20th century. How are we doing? Again, here's some of the challenge that remains. Let me work in terms of countries for a moment, that aspect of the triad. Here are the 10 most populous countries in which the navigators do not yet have any presence, any ministry. Now, the exciting thing is this. 4 of the top 5 that you see there, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Vietnam, and Turkey, we have surveyed and we are making plans to enter in the next couple of years. So we are seeking to be on track in terms of our primary aim and our strategic goal. We've done a lot of field surveys recently. In fact, in the last 16 months, our people have gone into 15 countries that you see identified there. And these thrusts were initiated in the grassroots by 9 different nationalities. It's no longer just the British or just the Americans. For example, the Costa Ricans have done a survey of Guatemala. The Malaysians have done a survey of Bangladesh. Now, surveys are fruitless unless they issue in geographic penetration and expansion. During the 1980s, we entered an average of 3 new countries each year, countries in which we had never previously had a ministry. In 1990, it was a good year. Tanzania, Sudan, Swaziland, and Cameroon. Next month, Turkey, Lord willing, if the war does not engulf that whole area. And in a couple of months later, Vietnam. So we are entering at least 3 new countries each year. And it's a concerted effort within this program of expansion to work with what are called restricted countries. That is, countries that either prohibit the preaching of the gospel, or they tend to imprison national believers, or they refuse access to people who carry the traditional missionary visas. In this turbulent world that we're living in, there are now some 76 significant restricted countries. Because these countries include both India and China, you see the very large percentages there. 66, two-thirds of the world's population and more than 80% of the world's unbelievers are in these restricted countries. What a challenge this is for a missions agency. Today we only have a presence in 26 of the 76 restricted countries, but you'll note that starting from a small base, we are rather committed and rather energetic at this stage, and we are putting 17% more staff into these countries every year. One of my responsibilities is to stimulate and empower and indeed celebrate this mission to move into restricted countries, and we describe it in this mission statement. What we call Project Access is an international partnership of commitments that we make to one another to help secure and sustain an authentic presence in these dark and difficult places of the world. Now, authentic presence, authenticity and incarnation, these are vital. This is our specialty. For example, we have been resident in India for 15 years, in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union for at least 10 years, in China for 10 years. And so our ministries are often highly contextualized because we believe in what you might call the with him principle. That is, that we don't just travel in and out. We don't just broadcast in. We need to be with the people for whom Christ died. 9 of the 15 countries into which we recently made surveys are restricted countries. There are wider and perhaps more significant ways of looking at what we call the frontiers. Here are 6 of them. You see, we can think of it politically in terms of the degree of freedom that men and women have, missiologically, educationally. We can think of the cities, and we can think of the religious and social environment in which the gospel needs to flourish, in which we are ambassadors for Christ. Now, to penetrate these frontiers, whichever way we like to look at it or analyze it, to penetrate these frontiers requires faith and courage and creativity. So, that's a little overview. Jim Peterson and Paul Stanley are going to give you more of a taste of some of the situations and people involved as they do that. And before they do that, I'd just like to remind you, the aim to multiply spiritual laborers, we do this very humbly, very dependent upon God's grace and his empowerment. Your prayers and your participation is crucial. But this objective that God has given us all, nothing could be more motivating. Thank you.
We had a wedding here in this great hall last Saturday. Our daughter married her Brazilian sweetheart, Eduardo. And at the reception, they have a Brazilian tradition where they take the groom's tie and a scissor and they go around and they sell little bits of it. And that helps finance the honeymoon. And I think that'd be a good idea, Donald, for your tie. I think we could probably... We could probably buy you a sports shirt. And so, just want to help. The theme of this conference is making a permanent impact on a secular culture. And I'm sure you'll be hearing more about what that means as Terry gives his report tomorrow. But simply put, a secular culture is a culture that gets along just fine without God, or thinks it does. In other words, God is not a part of its frame of reference. And what that means is that the USA and the West, Europe, Canada, they have become a vast mission field because that's the direction that these societies have gone. It also means that's what the Soviet Union is a secular culture. And as the religion of the Soviet Union has been communism or Marxism, then really their God has fallen. And so that is another secular culture. But another field that we are focusing on and aiming at are the frontiers. And Donald mentioned the frontiers a bit, but what we mean by the frontiers are those nations or those cultures that are... solidly either Buddhist, Hindu, Shintoist, Muslim, or Confucianism. It's the major religions of the world. And the fact is that we, the Christians, for the last 300 years that the missionary effort has been going on, first out of Europe and now out of the U.S., we have never really penetrated those cultures. We've never really penetrated those major religions. And why is the question. In a book by Paul Johnson, A History of Christianity, he gives this explanation. What was the failure of Christianity? It was the inability of Christianity to de-Europeanize itself, which caused it to miss its opportunities. The church presented itself as the extensions of European social and intellectual concepts rather than as embodiments of universal truths. Later he said, though Christianity was born in Asia, when it was re-exported there from Europe, from the 16th century onward, it failed to acquire an Asian face. Now, the fact is that these other religions view Christianity as being a Western religion. Now, that's strange, because where was Christianity born? It was born in the East. But as it took its trip around the world, up into Europe, and then across to the U.S., it acquired Western trappings, Western thought patterns, and everything else. And as we go into these frontier nations, this is one of the major obstacles that we face. We go to a nation, and we find that the nation is rejecting Christianity, not because of the essential message, but because of the trappings that it finds itself in. And so they won't take the gospel for the wrappings, for the package that it comes in. And that is the primary challenge that we face as we go into these cultures. And we are committed to taking the gospel into the heartlands of the nations where the religion is basically would be Buddhism or Islam or Hinduism or Shintoism. And this is a tremendous challenge, and it presents just unbelievably difficult circumstances as we try to proceed. Let me illustrate. I've been involved quite a bit with the nation of India over the past several years. Now, India has a population of 900 million people. 800 million of them are Hindu. Well, now, you're not going to change the culture of 800 million people. They are a nation. The question is, can the gospel flow inside of the Hindu culture? Well, if I understand my Bible, the answer has to be yes, it can flow inside of the Hindu culture. But that's walking a very fine line to see the gospel enter a culture and not pick up the trappings also of its religious heritage, which would be Hinduism. But our team there in India consists of one Australian, I guess he's from Scotland, and then about 30 Indians, many of them of Hindu background themselves. And what they're faced with as they look at the Hindu society, these 800 million people, is it's a closed system. It's 5,000 years old that gives easy answers to very difficult problems in society. The religion holds to about 60 million gods. Any particular individual, you can't handle 60 million, you can't keep track of them, but you manage to keep track of about 30. And you spend your life as a Hindu trying to keep an even keel between these 30 gods. And if you go to one too much, then you've offended this other one over here. And then you have to hire a Hindu priest to help you balance out and make this other god feel good. And so you spend money you don't have trying to keep the gods appeased. And so you come home and you're hungry, and instead of getting rice and something else to eat, you've got candles and incense. And people spend money, instead of buying food, they'll spend money on keeping the gods appeased. Reincarnation gives an easy answer to the difficult questions. You see a person laying in the gutter, suffering, and you think, well, he has it coming. He was really a louse in the last incarnation. And so, better luck next time. And so I don't have to concern myself with this person. There's no compassion in the society. And the person lives hoping for the time when he will escape from this cycle of reincarnation and attain what they call Atma, which is really oblivion. It's becoming one with eternal bliss, but there's no individuality to it. And so it's a hopeless environment. So often people say, well, you know, leave these religions. They live side by side. In fact, I heard a Christian woman the other day tell me, she said, well, truth is what these religions have in common. Well, I'll tell you what these religions have in common. And that is, they are all gripped by fear coming out of superstition. And if that's truth, then I don't want it. But the central truth of our message is that Christ delivers us from this kind of bondage. It is urgent to get to these people who are embracing these religions. Galatians 4:3 says, so also when we were children, we were in slavery under the basic principles of the world. And people who are in these religions, they are enslaved, controlled actually by terror of what could happen once they do not please the gods. But the difficulty is that as we reach people there, to be Christian and stay within their society is a very difficult thing for them to achieve. For instance, a young man comes to Christ, and he begins to follow Christ. He begins to grow in the scriptures.
and he wants to make his build his life around Christ. Well, then it comes time for him to get married. Well, the tradition there is that mom and dad choose the bride. And the marriage is arranged by the parents. So what would you do as a Christian young man? And mom and dad is going to find you a bride. And you think, man, I'm going to marry somebody that's going to have 30 gods on the shelf. And I'm going to smell incense and it'll be candles all over the house. I don't think I want that. And so you come to mom and dad and you say, well, but no thanks. I think I'll go find my own bride. And when you do that, you have repudiated the whole Hindu society and you become a marginal person in that society. That's one of the reasons the gospel has never gotten inside of Hinduism. Well, we've struggled with this one for years and prayed over it. How do you make that breakthrough? One day, a couple of years ago, about a year and a half ago, I was in India, and there's one young fellow. There were about three or four of these men that were faced with this dilemma that I was describing to you just now. And one of them, Sugumar, came to me and he said, you know, my parents said, Sugumar, if your God is as great as you say he is, can't you trust him to help us find you a wife that would follow your Christ? Now, what do you do with that? Don't be married to an unbeliever. And here's this mother saying, son, trust us to find someone that will follow your Christ. But how does he know that they'll find someone who will follow his Christ? So for the next year, Sugumar and John Ridgway, who leads our work in that country, worked together closely on this thing. And John became really the consultant of both parents on both sides on this, you know, should this couple get married. And what's at stake, note, is getting the gospel inside of the Hindu society so that it's not always being rejected and repulsed by the separation. Well, I was there again in September of this past year, and it happened that Sugumar's wedding was the 21st of September, and I attended. And the father of the bride made all the plans, and really this was just sort of a blind step of faith. Can we trust God to make this thing work out? And we were scared. Much to our surprise, the wedding was held in a church. And the father of the bride, of course, made all the plans. The person that performed the ceremony was sort of a Hindu Harry Belafonte. He carried on this dialogue. It was all in Hindi, and I couldn't understand it. And then he'd break into these songs that were quite similar to some of the calypso-type things that Belafonte sang. I thought it was terrific. But the guy is a believer who has kept the Hindu trappings. And these 30 guys that are part of our team, they just said, we've never seen anything like this. Well, what we found is that both families, because Sugumar has honored his parents' desires, they are wide open to the gospel. They're eager to hear, examine the scriptures. The next day after the wedding, what did you do the next day after your wedding? Well, but the next day after the wedding, Sugumar and his bride, Diva, came over to where John Ridgway and I were together. And they sat down, and Sugumar turned to me, and he says, well, now that we are married, what advice do you have for us? Well, I said, you're never going to make it if you don't make Christ the centerpiece of your marriage. And I sat there, and I explained the gospel to Diva. She sat there and just beamed. She's just a bright, beautiful young lady. I'd worry about my parents choosing my wife. I think I have better taste than they did, and I'm glad I could choose my own. But they did a good job when they chose this little gal for Sugumar. And it's just obvious that God's blessing is on this. And so we feel it remains to be seen. It'll take time to see whether this is really going to be a breakthrough into the Hindu society or not. But it has all the markings of it. But these are the kinds of dilemmas that we face. And we find that for our people in these countries to be able to do this kind of thing, they need two things. They need a very unusual grasp of the Scriptures. People with a weak grasp of the Scriptures are afraid to innovate. And so what they do, instead of obey the Scriptures, is they fall back on their old forms and old traditions. And that will not work in this situation. And we also realize that these people need to be unusually strong in their faith, because they will have to take steps that people have never taken before. And so the job of our leadership team is to help these people, our laborers in these countries, strengthen their grasp of the Scriptures and strengthen their faith and take these delicate steps that need to be taken to get into the frontiers. So that's what our job is.
It's really fun to move over back into the international field and moving out of the U.S. Involvement, and especially working with these three gentlemen. It's been a lot of fun. You rarely see them, but we're getting together periodically, probably on airplanes is where the best we can kind of convene. But if we could produce a newspaper, a spiritual newspaper, of what God is doing around the world, wouldn't it be exciting? Be certainly a lot better to read than some of the stuff we have to read today. But God is at work in so many places, and it's hard to even choose things to tell you that would be of interest, because they all would be of interest. I recently, this past November, was over in Korea, and you, of course, have perhaps heard of all the things that are going on in the Asian world and how the doors are opening and the hearts are opening in so many places. Well, Korea is just one of those. Or a nation at the turn of the century was less than 1% Christian and is now 34% Christian. The largest churches, evangelical churches in the world, are found in Korea. And our Navigator work started in the 50s there as well and has experienced great blessing. And while I was there talking with the Korean team, they had experienced 8,000 students coming to know Christ in this past year. And that was just the student ministry. But the challenge that's before them and the thing that they're excited about, and I was part of the series of conferences about missions, is that in a time where many of us, and particularly in America, are not able to send out as many missionaries as we have before, Korea is seeing this as a tremendous opportunity. And God is moving in them. And at these conferences that were focused on missions, over 1,500 Koreans stood and committed themselves to be available to go. And they are excited about it. And already they're starting to think and pray about China. They've been able to put some people there. They're moving a team into Sri Lanka. They're praying about the rice bowl countries, which is Vietnam and Thailand and Burma and some of these places. God is moving them and they want more. They want to be a part of moving the gospel and disciple making around Asia. So it's exciting to watch that and be a part of that and help them to link up with Asia and the rest of the opportunities and formulate a way in which they can do this and establish a base financially to send them out and to establish even connections with industries and possible businesses and educational institutions to put them in as bivocational missionaries. But it's exciting to watch that. Well, you can't read your newspaper, your secular newspaper, without reading something about Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union every single day. God has done an unusual thing there, and we're still figuring out how to respond to it. Back in August 1989, just a year and a half ago, I was attending a conference for our Eastern Europe and Russian leaders and our Navigator ministries throughout that part of the world. It was found, it took place in a small little East Germany village. It was quietly done, very secretly, undercover, and getting these people all there was a tremendous effort. And there I was, and I had to live outside the other town and kind of sneak back into this small little town to have the conference. And it was exciting to me, having been involved in the earlier days, to hear these 50-some leaders talk about what God was doing in their countries. And this was before it all broke loose. They were talking about things that were happening in Poland, East Germany, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Yugoslavia, Romania, Russia, and Glasnost had taken place just before that and was taking effect and had allowed these Russians even to come out. It was a real miracle. And God was doing things even among us. They were talking about the lives that were being touched and won for Christ by the hundreds and hundreds. They were talking about the disciples that were being raised up for the first time in their lives to have a relationship with God. And it was exciting to hear about how their thinking and values and purpose and meaning and life were being reshaped by the Word of God and the Holy Spirit and these little discipleship bands and groups that were forming in churches and homes and meeting all over the places. Hope was a new word in their vocabulary. The communist regime had just about destroyed that word, but new meaning was coming back into it. Disciples were being equipped to minister to others and to reproduce their lives spiritually. And multiplication was taking effect all through these different countries. Well, who would have ever thought that this happened? Who would have thought that right while we were meeting, the East Germans were trying to go through the Hungarian border into Austria, and every day when I'd come back, since I was staying in a little hotel that had a German television, and I would listen, and I'd come back to this little group, and I would tell about what happened. They'd all gather around. What happened? Are they letting them loose? Are they letting them loose? And I remember the Czechoslovakians saying, nothing like this could ever happen in our country. The Romanians were deeply discouraged, and they said, no, communism is so deep there, we could never get rid of it. But people were praying all over the world, and people have been praying. And the next months, of course, you know all about them. Walls fell. The grip, the death grip that communism had on these parts of the world was lost. Governments changed, and doors flung open. And it was tremendously encouraging. Well, what do you do in that situation? What do you go to? Do you shift your strategy? Because back in 1972, when we moved into those, it was a little band of navigator staff believed the Great Commission that we were to go into all the nations and make disciples. And so we started. We started with the ones and the fews, and then they just built them up, and they began to grow, and soon the fews turned into many, and the many turned into hundreds. And that just happened. And in 1979, I thought back to that, when I went in with several interpreters to introduce the Navigator ministry into the Russian countries. And it was really quite an event, because we had already been operating in Eastern Europe for a while, and God had been blessing, but Russia was the biggie. Russia's security and the intensity of persecution was so different than these other countries. Could we really travel like we had in these other countries? Could we get into these believers? Could we help them? And so we went in to actually introduce a cassette series of 36 teachings in discipleship, thinking that's all we could do. And through a very elaborate series of security measures, getting on this bus and going from the bus to a place and meeting two men who'd walk by in a dark suit, and it seemed like everybody had a dark suit. And we finally saw one, and somehow we looked at each other and felt like they were the ones, and we followed them a couple blocks, and sure enough, they led us into a car, and we drove off to another place to meet the number one man, head of the underground church movement in Russia. We walked in, and he had three or four men there. We spent hours getting in the Word, talking about discipleship, disciple-making, the training and equipping and the process. And they asked a lot of questions, what was going on out in Eastern Europe and other places. And finally, Khodiv, age 66, who was the leader, and 18 months after I left, he died in a prison for his faith. But Khodiv looked at me, a big brute of a guy, 6'4", tough Russian, walked with God for years. And he looked at me and he said, my name in Russian is Pavel. He said, Brother Pavel. He said, God has sent you here. He said, we have concentrated so long on the battle, we have forgotten to build the soldiers. God has sent you. Would you help us build the soldiers? And I kind of looked at these cassettes that we had there. And I said, well, we have these cassettes. I'm not sure what we can do. And he said, no, cassettes don't build soldiers. You must come. And so we did. And we began to move in there. A tremendous risk, and to the believers as well. And we began to find people, and things began to develop. And presently now in the Eastern Europe and Soviet Union, the doors are wide open. And people are excited. And everywhere I go in the evangelical world to say, man, let's pour it on. And we get all the literature that comes, and let's give, and let's get into those places. But it's tough. 40 years of communism and 70 years in the Soviet Union have left a people that are devastated. They have left a people, it's just like someone who's lived in a cave for years and suddenly have been brought out into the light. They are staggering and stunned. They are disoriented. They are fearful. They are groping. The economies are in a shambles. There's moral and spiritual vacuum. Deep insecurity, uncertainty, and fear. The opportunity is tremendous. It's unparalleled, but very difficult. There are obstacles and hindrances that we face and great confusion. Our teams are in place. Because of the years of ministry, we have hundreds of laborers, thousands of disciples, and all through these different countries, and more coming. And our mission remains the same, to build soldiers, like Hortif said, so that God can deploy them to win the lost and turn these nations to God. It's a tremendous challenge we face in that part of the world. And we as an international team are trying to integrate and help that happen and help them along with that. And this afternoon at 2 o'clock, Donald McGilchrist and I will be talking more specifically about the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe bloc. So I won't go into the details. And if you'd like to know more details of what we're doing and what's some of the things happening there, we'll take the time to do that. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul and Jim and Don. I get goosebumps as I hear what's going on, even though I know it and have heard it before. You know, we live in an incredible world today that's filled with opportunities and challenges, and you've just heard a little of how our small world of the Navigators is trying to reach some of these places and meet some of these needs. But we're committed to a world that is falling apart at the seams, and to equip people to live relevant lives in that world and train to meet those real needs, we need to help people grow deep in their roots with God so that their responses to the world around them are really authentic, as Jim has shared, and as Donald has shared, in the sense of being with them fully, and that these people cannot be dependent on professionals and experts. In many parts of the world, they're not there and available. And in many other parts of the world, particularly in the West, they are not wanted or part of people's thinking at all. They need to be what I call real people. Many of you probably read that little booklet or the little book called The Velveteen Rabbit. And you remember the little conversation that went on there between the Velveteen Rabbit and the Skin Horse in the bedroom of this little child's playroom, or in the playroom. And the Velveteen Rabbit says, "What is real? Does it mean having things a buzz inside you and a stick-out handle?" "Real isn't how you're made," said the Skin Horse. "It's a thing that happens to you. When a child loves you for a long, long time, not just to play with, but really loves you, then you become real. It doesn't happen all at once. You become. It takes a long time. Generally, by the time you are real, most of your hair has been loved off. And your eyes drop out, and you get loose in the joints and very shabby. But these things don't matter at all, because once you are real, you can't be ugly, except to people who don't understand." Like the Velveteen Rabbit, people around the world want people who are real and who feel with them and care with them and live with them, and they're committed to understand the plight and the dilemma of their lives and become their friends. And so we're committed to these nations, to the frontiers. And by the way, this is not theory. As you can see, we're there. And we're reaching Hindus and Muslims. We're in China, the Middle East, Eastern Europe, or what they now want to be called Central Europe, and Russia. And the vision of reproducing lives really does work. Many of you who have come here have had a part in supporting our staff around the world, these missionaries, and staff in the United States, and we want to thank you very much for your part with us. And we also want to ask you to join us in prayer for the outreach of the Navigators around the world. When you leave today, there will be a little publication called Worldwide that we in the International Office have put out, and that will be given to you, and just some other information of a summary nature that may help you And if you would like to get that worldwide on a regular basis, we plan to publish it 4 times a year. Please sign up for it. We don't just send it because you've been here to a conference. But if it's something, if you look at it, that you'd enjoy, please sign up for it. Thank you very much for being with us today. We hope this has helped you understand some of the work of the navigators around the world. So, Dave?